The following Dharma encounter with Jeffrey Shug and Arnold Roshi took place at Zen Mountain Monastery at the conclusion to a week-long meditation session. As you'll hear, Dharma encounters begin with the introduction of a topic related to Zen practice and training. Students then volunteer to present their understanding of the topic or a question for the Dharma encounter teacher to reflect on. The presence of fellow students means that anyone in attendance can benefit from the exchange. We hope you enjoy.
Good morning. Good morning, everyone. And good morning to all of you who are joining us. So this morning we were doing Shosan, which is Dharma Encounter. And it's been over a year since we've done this, thus just a little rusty. This is something that we do in our Sangha at the conclusion of every session during the Angos, spring and fall. And so with the pandemic last March and our shutting things down and how that affected everything and partly also because of not having a chief disciple, and just getting used to all of you being there rather than here. I didn't do Shosan during the last two Angos. Here we are now, a year later, and slowly taking our steps towards healing, recovering, and beginning to look towards showing up together again, and having a chief disciple in Shinji, and it just being time. we're doing Shosan this morning, Dharma Encounter. So the history of this sees its roots in all of the ways within the Buddhist tradition in which students and teachers would encounter each other, engage each other in the Dharma. In the Buddha, in terms of conversation, discussion, you know, said that basically if you're not talking about the Dharma, then why are you talking? that our attention is to be, within our practice, is to be focused on the teachings and developing our understanding. And so what are those conversations? What kind of communication is that? And so in training, there are different kinds of teachings. There's Taisho, which usually happens, which is a live discourse. There is Doksan, or Daisan, formal meetings with the teacher, private and confidential. There is practicing and living together, and the different kinds of communication that comes up in that. There's Mando, which is a informal question and answer, and then there is Shosan. And this is a little bit like face-to-face teaching in that it is face-to-face as students come up. It is a little like a public discourse or Mando in that it is interactive, more like a Mando. It shares in those different forms of communication and teaching, and also goes back in terms of just how, as students, we engage our teachers in, and vice versa, in study and practice and trying to illuminate our minds, because that really is at the heart of our, not only our practice and our purpose in being here together, but also our interaction and our communication. Although that takes many forms, formally and informally, from a Buddhist perspective, all of that should be leading us towards developing our mindfulness, our concentration, bringing forth a great heart of compassion, and illuminating that which is not yet seen clearly. Shosan means Dharma encounter, and so Shosan Shi is the teacher of the Dharma encounter, in this case today, myself. And so I have, I'm going to present some points from the things that we're studying. And so part of this is the spontaneity of it, is you don't know what I'm going to present, and I don't know what you're going to present when you come up. We will be doing this morning just with the residents. One of the things is how important that part of it is, and so we've looked at how would that work if we were to bring in those of you at home and, you know, handling the technology part of it. And so we've decided to just stay with the face-to-face, and since only a certain number of people can come up anyway, many of the Sangha are experiencing it by witnessing. And so just to acknowledge that will be happening today. And so in that way, it gives also everyone an opportunity to sort of listen in and be a part of other people's conversations, other people's encounters and questions and minds. With face-to-face teaching, all of that happens. You know, through all of the years I studied with my teacher, I really had no idea what was going on for anybody else, although I had lots of imaginations about that. And that's part of its purpose, is that it really keeps it very, very contained between the student and the teacher, that it's really just for that student. What is happening in that moment is just for that student. It's not a general teaching, as needs to happen in a larger context. It's just for that student. And also to help retain the power of that, we ask people to really hold that within themselves and not speak about it publicly.
The following Dharma encounter with Jeffrey Shug and Arnold Roshi took place at Zen Mountain Monastery at the conclusion to a week-long meditation session. As you'll hear, Dharma encounters begin with the introduction of a topic related to Zen practice and training. Students then volunteer to present their understanding of the topic or a question for the Dharma encounter teacher to reflect on. The presence of fellow students means that anyone in attendance can benefit from the exchange. We hope you enjoy.
So what I wanted to draw from this morning are the teachings that we're working with. First, Dogen's 10 directions. And so in that fascicle, Dogen says, the 10 direction Buddhas, in the 10 directions land, are neither large nor small, neither pure nor stained. When we open the Buddha Sutras transmitted to China, from China, and look at the details of Shakyamuni Buddha's lifetime of teaching, we see that he never regarded some Buddhas as inferior and other Buddhas as superior, nor did he call some Buddhas not Buddhas. What is not found in the Buddha's teachings are judgments on other Buddhas. Dogen also says, regarding this, Shakyamuni Buddha said, I just know the essence. So do the Buddhas in the 10 directions. And then Dogen, commenting on that, said, know that I just know the essence is to draw a circle. And this drawn circle means that pole is that long. That pole is this long. This pole is this long. Okay? This morning we chanted the identity of relative and absolute. So to use language, what is the relationship between that body of reality, that dharmakaya, that essential nature? I just know the essence. That has no characteristics, no fixed form, no location, can never be touched, is beyond measure, and is the nature of everything. What is the relationship between that, to speak of it awkwardly, and everything in what we call the world? Everything we can see and hear and taste and touch and feel and think. And so the poem we chanted this morning as a teaching speaks of like a box in its lid, like the foot before and the foot behind in walking, like two arrows meeting in midair, how to try and convey the sense of the perfect integration, the perfect unity of what we speak of as the absolute and relative, these two aspects of reality, one reality, which is present in everything, in every moment, within each of us, and is the fundamental matter of Mahayana Buddhism. Why is this important? Why is this the fundamental matter? Why does Buddhism, particularly Mahayana Buddhism, focus so deeply on understanding, practicing, and then realizing, coming in direct encounter with what we call the absolute? Everything beyond, all that is beyond, that which is beyond, everything that we touch, everything that we relate to, everything that we think that matters, everything in the world, the place where everything that is dear to us resides. Why does Buddhism emphasize so deeply the practice and realization of that, that which we call the absolute, the ultimate, the essence? And here, essence, which often, you know, is defined as that which, the intrinsic nature of something, is not how we mean it here, okay? It is specifically not a intrinsic nature. It is talking more about the essential. So why is that important? Why is emptiness important in our practice? Why is understanding, realizing independent origination, that all things arise at the same time, are co-created? That nothing that we can think or see or touch or conceive or encounter has any essence, has any intrinsic quality. Why is that important? And not as a philosophical idea, but as a direct experience. And to see that in thoughts and emotions, in time, circumstances, and in things. How is that liberation? How does that liberate us? Avalokiteshvara, doing deep prajnaparamita, clearly saw emptiness of all the five conditions, the skandhas, thus relieving misfortune and pain. How does that relieve misfortune and pain? And why does Dogen say that Buddha's saying, I just know the essence, is to draw a circle? And that circle means that pole is that long and this pole is this long. What's the connection? In the faith mind, Sengtsan says, the great way is not difficult if you just do not pick or choose. When love and hate are both absent, the way is clear and undisguised. If you make the slightest distinction, a hair's breadth of difference, then heaven and earth are set far apart. So our mind is designed, is beautifully created to differentiate so we can navigate our world. And in that, it discriminates long this pole from this pole, high from low, wall from door, right from wrong. Is that intrinsically suffering? The Buddha said life is dukkha, life is suffering. All conditioned things are dukkha. Does that mean dukkha, suffering, intrinsically exists in conditioned things? If so, what does that mean? If not, why not? What does that mean? Is it possible for the mind to have a direct experience without naming, without dividing, without picking and choosing? Can there be hatred without duality? Can there be love without duality? Can we recognize a hair's breadth of difference? You and I are not the same. Without a sense of inherent separateness, without that leading to love and hate. When the Buddha said, I just know the essence, what was he speaking of? How do you practice picking and choosing? How do you practice loving and hating such that the way is not difficult? When a hair's breadth difference appears and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart, what now? How do we even recognize that? Are there preferences, likes and dislikes, in the 10 directions that the Buddha speaks of? When the Dogen says, or the Dogen speaks of, where he says, a fist, just this, is the 10 directions, a sincere heart? Just one sincere heart is crystal clear in the 10 directions? Are there likes and dislikes here? If not, then does an enlightened being no longer like anything? Does an enlightened being have no love? Then how do we explain the great compassion, the great love of the Bodhisattva? If the 10 direction Buddhas in the 10 directions land are neither large nor small, neither pure nor stained, then how does an enlightened being recognize delusion? How do they offer skillful means? How do they guide sentient beings? So how do these very deep, profound teachings, which are subtle, as the Buddha said, and difficult to understand, and being difficult to understand, we could just think, well, that's philosophical, that's theoretical, that's not me, that's not my life. But it's only about our lives. So how do we understand this? Okay, so that's my part to begin. So Shinji will lead us off. And when she comes up, she'll do 3 bows as a chief disciple before and after she has her time here. Everyone else will just do 1 bow. And we're going to just be drawing from the residents. So since some of you are just experiencing this for the first time, some of you who are more experienced can put yourselves on the line as examples. But it would be nice to have all of you have a chance at this. We may not have time for everyone, but please, this is the time when you can go ahead and get on line and we'll begin.
Shosanji, does one sincere heart arise from emptiness?
Chief Disciple, does one sincere heart arise from emptiness?
Thank you for your teaching.
And I request a response. Ah! How are we to understand this as emptiness? How is that liberation or liberating? And liberating.
When I am doing my best, I forget what I'm doing.
How does that liberate others?
I don't distinguish between the self, myself, and others. The heart reaches.
And this heart, is this something that lives in your chest? this sincere heart.
The sincere heart.
Can you speak up?
The sincere heart lives here.
Then how can you give it away if it lives there?
I don't distinguish between here and there.
Okay, may your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching.
I think it's worth saying, it's okay, that that when a student of understanding speaks from a place of understanding, that can sound like an absolute statement that is true at every moment. And it is. And it isn't. It's true in every moment because that is the essence. It isn't because that doesn't, being able to speak from understanding in one moment doesn't mean that that is always the lived experience in every moment. And so it is both an expression of what is true all the time, universally in every place, and is also an expression of our practice and aspiration.
Shosan Shi, I love, I absolutely adore cows, and to see videos and read about occurrences where they're tormented and tortured and their babies are stolen from them, it crumbles me. Mm-hmm. And I know milk tastes delicious. I know it's addictive. And I offer it to whomever wants it, freely, without judgment.
So how does your love for cows and the distress at their suffering, then how do you practice that teaching? The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences.
I do everything I can for them. Mm-hmm. And I don't drink milk. Mm-hmm. I know it.
And how do you experience that pain without becoming destroyed by that pain? In other words, how can that pain help you to be free?
The pain is so immense that it's also I understand why we do that, why it occurs, and I don't have to understand why, but I guess it helps, and that what's your question again?
So let me just say, so I'm asking the question, what is the relationship? Why, like a box in its lid, like a step before and a step after, two arrows meeting in midair, why these metaphors to try and give us a sense of this perfect union, this perfect unity? And so how to take that, which is very real to you, right, which is alive in you, and so you can experience that sense of that pain and suffering, both within the animals and within you, as being real. It exists, it's having an effect, right, and consequence, right? It's tangible, it seems to have a sense of solidity, right? And so then how to take these teachings, right? Bring them into that experience, right? So here, what is, I just know the essence? And here, what is, this is to draw a circle and to know what is long and what is short, what is pain and what is the alleviation of that pain. To challenge ourselves, to understand, to be practicing these teachings, but really to be wrestling with the implications of this in this life.
Okay. I don't know why I'm here, but I know completely. Mm-hmm.
Well,
that
you
I should
may
be
not.
Here.
You may not, but someone does. May your life go.
Thank you for your teaching.
What's that?
You have so many questions, teacher. We do. How do you pick and choose them?
How indeed?
I just see the one sitting in front of me.
Mm-hmm. And is that a long one or a short one?
No top or bottom.
Mm-hmm. So then how can you speak to me?
I would love to help you if you would tell me what you need.
How do you help when you can't understand my asking?
Just keep listening as best I can.
Can you do more than that?
Can you ask me again?
How can you help when you don't understand my asking for help?
I don't understand.
Then how can you help?
I don't know. No help.
Then how do you know if you're alleviating suffering?
I don't know.
Dangerous.
Very.
Is that a place of vast space, or is that a little cave in the wall?
I love both of them, but...
Be careful about that cave in the wall.
I live there a lot.
But here you are.
You enticed me out of the cave, what can I say?
May your life go well.
Thank you for teaching.
So, a cave is just a cave. How does it become a place of awakening? How does it become a place of hiding? Is that in the cave?
I hope that one's not for me. You've asked a lot of questions. For me, the same question keeps coming up about this relationship between the absolute, the box and its lid. I can sense it. I can feel it. I don't think I can explain it any more than the acorn.
The acorn?
The acorn knows. Well, the acorn knows. The acorn knows how to grow into an oak tree. It's implicit. It's inherent to the acorn.
But then why doesn't every acorn become an oak tree?
Circumstances.
Indeed. So... You know, sometimes students will ask, they'll come into Dokusan and say, I know, I understand, I just can't express it. And I'll say, it's important to express it. And they'll say, why? Why isn't just knowing important? And I'll say, how do you know that you understand? And so, in articulating, in expressing the inexpressible, right? That's why language is so necessary. And so imperfect to even talk about the relationship between. It's like, what is the relationship between wet and water? Between space and sky, right? It doesn't make sense. And yet, we speak of space and we speak of sky. And it can serve, right? And so we speak of relationship between essence and drawing a circle. But one of the things that reason it's important to express it is because, you know, we are feeling beings. We sense our world in many ways. And we sense things that we don't understand. And we have a sense oftentimes that there's something true in that. How do we know? It is true in the sense that we are having an experience. There's that level of truth. Is it something that is a trustworthy guide?
Exactly.
In the element of mindfulness, ardency, is this something that we want to be cultivating? Or is it something that's more like of our habit, mind, and that is actually going to fool us? Right? And so that's where the sense of feeling, we can't not have it. We can't not use it because in practice we're having all kinds of experiences that are actually showing us, are guiding us. Sometimes they're pointing out our delusion. Sometimes they're pointing us out the way. But feelings are also not wholly reliable, right? And so that's where that Dharma body, encountering that Dharmakaya body that has no, in which there is no feeling, there is no sensation, right? And so what does that even mean? You know, so the dualistic mind thinks, wait a minute, are you telling me to go to some place there where there is no feeling and live there forever? Mm-hmm. Right? That's the mind that the dualistic mind, which makes absolute, just a pointing in a direction that actually isn't saying that at all. But our mind creates that, right? If it's not this, absolutely, it must be this, absolutely. And so to say that we need to be able to go beyond feeling, we can hear as saying feelings are wrong or bad, or we need to live somehow without them. Again, it's that creating of that sense of absolute, which is not so. And so, where does that leave you? When you started out by saying you have these feelings that you can't express. So what?
It leaves me with poetry. It leaves me in the middle of session, going out and seeing the moon and. She's a being, a luminous being, as I walk up the path.
Okay, perfect. So the moment before she becomes a luminous being, before. Mm. Before a hair's breadth difference. Mm. Enter there.
Just the moon. Glowing.
Before it is the moon. May your life go well.
Thank you for your answer.
Shosanchi, one question I've always had is, since I've been practicing, is, why do human beings get to this place where things are separated, where there's this, you know, when a baby is born, it when it comes out into this world, there is the relative and the absolute, but it seems to, I mean, it can distinguish, it knows its mother. Mm. And yet, as it grows older...
Do you think it suffers, that baby?
Well, they say that, you know, we don't remember our birth, but there is a certain amount of suffering, I think, in that birth for the baby.
Have you ever heard a baby wail?
Yeah. That's true. But, you know, as they grow older, why do they... everything becomes separated? And I've heard parents say this so many times, that they're horrified when they see their children... create these separations. Mm-hmm. You know, I hate her. She did this to me at school or whatever.
Okay. So,
other animals don't seem to do that.
Well, there is aggression. Uh-huh. I mean, other species do have aggression, mm-hmm. But you know, we've meddled with them for so long, maybe we can let them work themselves out, because they actually seem to be able to do that okay.
Yeah, that's what I'm...
We, on the other hand, have some work to do. So is there intrinsic suffering? The Buddha said, life is dukkha, all conditioned existence. I mean, everything that arises as a result of karmic actions, intentional actions, and conditions, consciousness, sense organs, sense objects, and the world that we live in, the conditions of this time and place, are all the dependent causes of every experience. And he said, that is dukkha. Was he saying that's intrinsic in each moment, each event, each action, each dharma? So when an infant begins to learn to recognize the difference between mother and father, right? Between siblings, between playmates, right? Is the hatred that you, or the whatever it is, the greed or the... Mm-hmm. Is that intrinsic in the recognition of those differences?
No, I don't think that it is. I mean, I don't know.
Then where is it coming from?
You could say that it's learned, but I know it's confusing to me. I mean, you can't.
Well, what do the teachings say?
Well, I don't. You know, does the Buddha say that that it is intrinsic? Like the suffering that we create, and we do create it. Mm-hmm. Is that inherent in all human beings?
No. Because there's nothing inherent. So that being so, how do we free ourselves of the illusion that it is inherent? Because that's what he was pointing to.
Right.
It seems like it is inherent. Mm. Right. When I see something. Right. Something that gives me great pain. Doesn't it feel like the pain is in that thing?
Yeah.
That thing is painful, right? And therefore I am experiencing it, right? And so, what do we do?
What do we do? Well, we practice. I mean, it's
well, wait, but what does that mean?
It's a convenient answer. I mean, I loved, you know, when Sean was talking about. You know, in her talk the other day about seeing the Zendo set up, and she went through that whole thing, and you know, at the end, it was just like she as a longtime practitioner recognized all these things, mm-hmm. how her mind was working. Mm-hmm. I mean, most people wouldn't. I mean, they wouldn't even know to go there. I mean, to.
And so, recognizing mind, mm-hmm. and that the suffering of this moment is in my mind. Does that mean that what I see out there has nothing to do with it?
No, I mean,
like two arrows meeting in midair, like a box in its lid. Mm-hmm. And that's why in the Mahayana, to just liberate my mind from the suffering of my emotion or my thoughts, my mental habits, is not yet enlightenment.
Right.
Because there is this suffering. And in the moment when I liberate my mind, all minds are liberated. All minds, all suffering is liberated. And that pole is that long and this pole is this long.
Yeah.
That suffering is slight and that suffering is immense. It is all one reality.
Yeah, and I understand that intellectually, but I haven't realized that yet. And hopefully I will at some point.
So appreciate that is what we are practicing all mm-hmm. the time. We're practicing, we are those two arrows. You are those two arrows. You are the box and the lid. And that when we are practicing, we are smack in the middle of that. Because there is no other place. It is everything. It is every moment. And so we don't, but it takes time and practice to see that that's what we're in the middle of, mm-hmm. right? And that's why in training, there is not an absolute sort of emphasis or path towards realizing that absolute, because that cannot be. There is no absolute. So, but while there is an emphasis on mindfulness and developing concentration, calming the mind, and seeing into the self nature of mind, emptiness. You are living with other people. You are serving. You are fulfilling responsibilities. You are interacting. Mm-hmm. You are getting dressed. You are dealing with your hunger. You are reading the news. It's happening. Mm-hmm. Right? And so, but we should really ask that question. We should be asking that question. How, if we have faith in these teachings, and we're devoting so much of our energies to them, then how is this liberating me in the moment when it's not? In other words, how is it helping me to liberate myself in the moment when I am not free? Because mm-hmm. I'm so in pain.
Yeah, caught up in that.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. May you life.
Thank you for your teaching.
So, Sanjay. It'd be easier for me to talk about no separation from the rain forest.
So that's a good place to start.
Yeah, but harder with what happened in Atlanta. Because this very moment is not separate from mine. This world is mine. One mind, not two. Our mind, the mind that we all create, mm-hmm. created Atlanta, mm-hmm. and created both sides of it. Mm-hmm. It's.
So what does it mean to not separate yourself here?
It's pain is what's not to separate. Mm-hmm. And yet, you have to do dishes. You have a schedule. You got to live with the pain.
Well, but let's stay with the pain for a minute. So, how does the pain, is suffering inherent in what we're calling pain, which is something that's happening right now? Is suffering inherent in that? When you look into that, this moment, right now, what's happening inside of you? Can you find something called pain? Can you find something called suffering? So what is that showing you? What are the two arrows meeting?
Where do they meet?
What are the two arrows meeting in that, in that place? Do you understand what I'm asking? Mm-hmm. There is something there. We're feeling it.
Yeah.
You're feeling it. And when you look to find it, to locate it, you can't find it. Those are the two arrows. So where do they meet?
But here's everywhere, midair.
Always closer than we think. So now, how to reflect on how can that help you in holding tragedy, in holding pain, and not just a pain of a moment, but a pain of generations, of histories, of systems, of people, a pain that we're all part of. How does that help you? So it's not just that this Dharma body is not just restricted.
It's the root of all compassion. It's the root of all compassion. I know what it means to be hated mm-hmm. for what I am. Mm-hmm. So I understand.
act. I can listen. And so that's love. You see someone, you see a fellow resident, and she just...
I don't know. I don't know it until I experience it.
Exactly. Because you are having an experience. You are having an experience that you're describing as solidness. And we all know that. That's a universal human experience. And that experience, right, is compelling, to say the least. And so, rightly, right, it's hard to understand how this can be helpful when before it's our sort of direct experience. And so that's where faith in the teachings, which you clearly have. And that's why practicing, you know, and Kenjo said, you know, it's easier to go and see the moon or to be drawn in by something that has its door wide open. And so, in a sense, we practice what we might think of as the small things. And so we go to our cushion and we find our breath, right? And then we encounter all kinds of trouble. And thoughts arise. And many of them are very reasonably harmless, you know, just everyday ordinary thoughts. Others have a little bit more weight, but we're practicing all of them. And so with those things that are sort of softer and gentler and lighter, of less consequence, we're starting to develop our ability. And so what might help is to rather than think of how is emptiness helpful or significant or why is it so significant, think in terms of letting go, which is a way of speaking of emptiness, or impermanence, or shift, or change. Why are those things important? Because those things we can see more clearly why those things are important. Those are all manifestations of emptiness. And so, you know, what Taisho and what we, these are the greatest challenges, right? Those things that are the most significant to us and that may be at the root of our deepest suffering, because everything is there. All of the worlds are there. And so in training, you know, training is very practical at the same time that it is profoundly mystical, right? Because it really does want you to be free. And so, and all of us. And so we really start where we are and where we can. We start where we can start. And we shouldn't underestimate the importance of that. And that's not like, you know, training wheels. It's the real thing. It's just the real thing in a little bit more accessible, you know, presentation so that we can actually begin to understand directly. It's happening, in other words, already.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? May your life go well.
Thank you for your teaching. Shosan. I still cannot say
it. Shosan.
Every time I come up here, Shosan Chi. All right. Well, there were so many different questions and so many points. Mm. And what came up for me is also after your talk yesterday about the mental maps we have. Mm. I was thinking about awareness, right? That maybe that's the only way to figure out in my life where I grasp, where I reject, where I... And I tried it this morning with the residents. You know, we come down and, you know, the silence and you pay attention. It's unbelievable, right? You know how I reject. And I think that's where you can only have the choice to liberate yourself if you are aware of what you're doing, right?
Well, yes, and I think we always need to be careful when we think in terms of it all comes down to this.
Uh-huh. That's true.
Yeah. Right. Because we're trying to like make everything very manageable. And in one sense, you're right. If you really put everything into what you're calling awareness. In other words, if awareness includes the whole. And it is understood.
And that it's changing all the time, too.
But I mean the whole of the universe, the whole of the path, the whole of everything. Mm-hmm. In other words, it's not just, I'm aware that you're sitting in front of me. Mm-hmm. And it is nothing apart from that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The two arrows meeting. Mm-hmm. And so that we're not trying to, you know, create a reductionist approach to practice.
Right.
You know, if I just do this, then I don't have to think about anything else.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so, without that awareness, as an active, engaged, sincere practice, then in a sense, all we can do is talk about practice. Mm-hmm. We're not really doing it. Mm-hmm. And that's why it is, for us, and our experience and practice of the Dharma, that is central. And then in that and through that, we meet everything.
Through the awareness.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It is your door.
Relative to the mental maps.
Everything. Mm-hmm. Okay. May your life go on.
Thanks for your teaching.
Shosanchi. The way this teaching occurs for me is that we have this potential in all moments, in all actions, to do great harm. Mm-hmm. And to attempt to do what is good.
Why do you present that so much more timidly?
I'm nervous.
But not nervous about doing great harm?
I feel like it's pretty easy, actually. You know, one person's harm is another person's good. I see that a lot in myself, in the opinions and that people have and the opinions that I have might be hurtful to someone. And it's hard, actually, to know if you're helping.
Yeah. Well, and so in that way, it is important to know, right? We do want to know that our practice is having a good effect.
Yeah.
And so when we talk about not knowing, that arises because we have been practicing in a way that we do know, we have known, that our practice is having a positive effect. The point at which the precepts become invisible and so integrated that we're not so self-conscious of them is because we have been very conscious of them.
Yeah.
That's how we get there, right? It makes me think of, but that sort of penchant that we have for, you know, towards the harm that we cause and the way we can be much more suspicious or doubtful of the good, it makes me think of something one of my students said, who may be here today, who rides his bike a lot in New York City, everywhere, and was talking to me one day about, you know, how irritated and frustrated and angry he gets with people who cut him off and aren't paying attention and threaten his life and so on, you know. And then one day he was riding to the temple, same thing, same bike, same person, same city, same everybody, and there was just a slight shift. And he realized, he suddenly was aware of the innumerable people, the many, many more people who were watching out for him.
Yeah.
The one on his way to the temple that cut him off was the one that became the whole.
Yeah.
And was keeping him from seeing all of the people that he was passing in every block who had him in their sights. That, I think, is something we have to, that is a inclination we have. We recognize that. And it's something particularly in our time where we are flooded with so much of one flavor, right? It is true and it's not true at the same time. Things are happening. We do need to know. We do need to respond. And there is much, much more than that. And in you. May your life go on.
Thank you for your teaching.
Well, I was feeling extremely nervous, which I am right now, and feeling the way my heart's beating in my chest, going forward and backward, forward and backward, and the breath going up and down, and up and down, and just a little bit of a trembling in the body, and thinking about all the people watching here in the room and through the camera who...
Hundreds.
And none of them are moved by what I'm feeling.
Are you sure?
Well, not in the same way, because they're seeing, they're witnessing, and I think that this is the circle right here with me trembling and the Sangha witnessing without judgment, the great mind always witnessing without judgment, and to remember that too, that I need to remember that, because I forget, and that what's causing this fear is that I think that there are all these judging minds and judging bodies, but the truth of the matter, the essence, is free from that.
Yes.
Free from that.
Thank you. Can I ask you one question? In expressing and helping us to see and feel all that you were experiencing, as you were giving that words, did that have an effect?
Yes. It sort of unravels the entanglement and lets it dissipate. There's like a knot that as I let it out, it just kind of expands and opens.
And so there's so many teachings, and we all have the experience of how sometimes describing or labeling, naming something makes it more entangled. Why do you think it had the other effect for you now?
Because it's true.
But it is always true. Why in your expressing it the way you did it have that more disentangling, calming effect, do you think? What's the difference?
When I connect to myself in an honest way and let other people hear it, I can see that there's no reason to be afraid.
May your life go well.
Shosanchi, even this judging mind is a miracle.
How do you say?
I love that. I think Eduardo's doing really well with the flowers, actually.
Is there anything lurking within that?
Always.
Like?
Possible danger. Very, very slippery.
Who knows what will happen next time?
Indeed.
He may disappoint you so badly.
I am sure it's imminent.
Okay, so I know that these questions are alive for you.
Very alive. Mm-hmm. You know, when you were talking yesterday in your talk and you gave that list of, like, here are some common misconceptions mm-hmm. that we can have, mm-hmm. Particularly at the beginning of practice, right. which I so appreciated, by the way. Thank you for that. And then later, well, even as you were naming them, I was like, oh, right. Like you said, we think duality bad. And I was like, oh, yeah, I get stuck there all the time. Still, it's just more subtle.
Yes. Yeah, and it's, you know, in a way, it's not our fault. It's the function of language,
yeah.
you know, which is so, talk about miracles. And dangerous.
Yeah.
You know, it's like we are using these forces that are so powerful and that we may understand so little. You know, so it's like our time in every direction is showing us we have to really grow up fast. We have to become who we are. And so you know, to hear, you know, to bring your attention to your breath and to let go of thoughts, that the slightest distinction separates heaven and hell. You know, to arrest our mind when we see it creating the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Those teachings are trying to point to how that moment. In a sense, they're trying to elicit the problem so that we can see it.
Mm.
We can see that the subtle ways in which our mind separates what is inseparable, divides what is indivisible, concretizes what is a miracle of appearing and appearing and appearing and appearing. And so, yeah, you know, somebody later commented on that sort of list of misunderstandings. And I, if I remember correctly, it says something about where I might have found those, you know, in texts and so on. I said, no, I found them from my own experience, right? Those are all misunderstandings I have had,
uh-huh.
you know?
Uh-huh.
And that it's, you know, I think one of the difficulties in every way in which we are looking under that rock is what we find is pain, whether it's our delusion, whether it's racism, misogyny, all the forms of oppression, there is pain. And when we begin to become acquainted with that pain, there is almost always anger, fury. And so all of that is what we have to work with. And it arises in small ways and arises in large ways. And when it arises without knowing, it becomes a catastrophe.
Uh-huh.
Right? Why is it that it's men that are always the mass killers? What have we created? What are we creating? What are men learning? What are men not learning? That this is our fruit. And how do we free us of that, in that? And so, you know, that's why, you know, part of the challenge of the teachings is because they are so powerful, right? They have to convey things that are very difficult to understand. At the same time, that in certain ways, they're very simple.
Uh-huh.
So simple.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And that, but in the challenge of engaging such profound truths, they can become abstract and theoretical and philosophical. And that's why I say these things, right? About how is this helping you? How is this helping you? And there's this danger that of wanting to constantly sort of concretize it, of wanting to, you know, have it be an exchange. I do this, I get this. And it is about alleviating suffering. And so it should be. And so to really be, you know, particularly when we are struggling and we are practitioners, we have refuges, right? To be asking that question, okay, now how is this practice which I'm devoting so much attention to and these teachings which I study and have faith in, how do I bring them to this moment? That's a honest question, right? You don't have to have the answer. You don't have to have the answer. But if you don't have the question, you're not going to get there. We're not going to get there. And so we should, let's ask that question. How is this serving me? Right? And others. Yeah?
Thank you for your teaching.
May your life go on. I feel like what those of you who came up today offered, I didn't have to do much. That you really did the work. So thank you. And you know, there's so many times along the way when I've thought, reflected back on the ways in which I, entering into this practice, particularly into training, upping the ante, that I reflected on, thought about, and anticipated all the ways in which it was going to be challenging and difficult, and all the ways in which I hoped it would be liberating and wonderful. And, you know, most of that was like, didn't amount to much, but that it was so much more and continues to be so much more challenging in ways that I could have never imagined, and so much more splendorous and joyful than I could have ever imagined. And how those two go together and help each other. You know, I don't know what it was like for the Buddha, of course, or Dogen, or even my own teacher, much less any of you. Somebody who is completely enlightened, somebody who has deeply realized, who has seen much more than I have in my humble practice. But to allow ourselves to both be troubled by our trouble and to have deep faith in our goodness. And by goodness, I mean more than you can possibly imagine. I think is a nice box in its lid. Are good traveling companions. And so I just want to end with words from the faith mind. Accord with your nature, unite with the way, and you will walk freely and undisturbed. When thought is in bondage, the truth appears hidden, and everything seems murky and unclear. And this burdensome practice of judging brings annoyance and weariness. What benefit can be derived from distinctions and separations? And so in our distinguishing, and differentiating, to know that there is a vast, boundless goodness. I think that's enough.
Thanks for listening. Did you know that Zen Mountain Monastery is live streaming all Dharma Talks and daily Zazen during the coronavirus quarantine? Visit our website to learn about all the online programs being offered at this time. Just go to zmm.org and click on the link at the very top of the page, or scroll down and click on Retreats.